Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's great to have everybody here joining us for this week's episode. And I am really excited about getting into some interagency cooperation and teamwork, and we're going to talk a little bit about that later on in this episode. Before we get to that, though, we have to talk about the team here on the show, and of course, my most important team member, Sam Bradley.
Thanks, Jimmy. Well, we're kind of real wet here in Colorado right now, at least my part of Colorado. Just about every day this time of year, we get, you know, thunderstorm warnings, but usually we get a few drizzles. But today we have a little monsoon, and it was pretty heavy there for about an hour. So, Kyle, what do you have to say about that?
Well, Sam, we're in a monsoon season here in Colorado, so these afternoon thunderstorms are just becoming more and more common and wreaking some havoc, both on the Front Range as well as up closer to where I am here in the Roaring Fork Valley near Aspen, Colorado. Last week, I had a couple of my friends whose houses were inundated with some flash floodwaters that came down out of a narrow canyon and brought mud and all kinds of nasty stuff in with it. So some hyperlocal, pretty intense impacts there, but if we want to kind of expand out and look nationwide, there's several events to talk about here, both weather-wise and also some kind of wilderness medical impacts as well. Starting off, there was a widespread damaging wind event across the Northeast United States on August 4. And following up that, there were several tornadoes in the Central Plains, including one that injured several people in the Tulsa, Oklahoma area back on August 5. Looking back now to August 4, in Summit County, Utah, there were three young sisters who were on a camping trip with their family in the Uinta Mountains, about 10 miles from the Wyoming border, when they were sadly struck by lightning. One of the sisters, as reported, was hit directly, and the father of those girls was able to give CPR to the two eldest girls and revive them before emergency personnel arrived. The youngest sister is in now saying fair to good condition at this time. So we had talked about lightning and lightning medical things in a previous episode, so definitely go back and listen to that. And finally, this is a video I'll have to have Jamie include. If anyone's seen this, definitely drop it.
I'm sorry, Kyle, we missed the end of that.
You kind of fell out there. You still with us?
I'm not sure. So we'll go ahead and find whatever video that was. It'll be linked in the show notes while Kyle gets things reset. So looks like he's got a connection problem. He'll join us back in here a little shortly. But, you know, there's another weather event coming up. And, Joe, you talked about it when the little pre-show discussion we had, the upcoming eclipse and the way that areas are planning for the coming of the eclipse, which is not something I thought that disaster planners and emergency planners would have to do, but I guess that it is something that makes a little bit of sense.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Jamie. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the podcast. I spent part of my day today reading a 64-page-long planning document for the state of Tennessee related to this eclipse event that's coming up in about 10 days. And, you know, just the amazing amount of work that's gone into planning and consequence management and all the other pieces that are part of an event that's likely to last just a few minutes during a single day. But, you know, I think the concerns about the impact on transportation, et cetera, are pretty profound, including worries about people just pulling over on the interstate to watch the eclipse and the traffic issues that may cause. And, in addition to that, the amazing amount of interagency work being done at the planning level to be able to respond and deal with the potential consequences of this pretty amazing event we're going to see pretty soon.
Who would have thought? But that's just another example. I mean, as many different disasters as we've discussed, us, that's the first there. One would not consider that a disaster, but I guess in some cases it certainly could be. Well, but speaking of disasters,
about stressing the system, right? I mean, that's what we talk about when we overload the resources available. When Kyle was talking earlier about the fact that some areas are going to have a significant increase in population, and they're not necessarily vacation areas that are used to that kind of surge. So it can be challenging. Is that right, Kyle?
Absolutely. And that's something that many states, we're talking statewide, are preparing to be have these local areas that rarely ever see this much of an influx of people just truly inundated. For example, Larimer County up in northeast Colorado is asking for state support in monitoring social media just because of the huge influx of people. And they're not even in the line of total eclipse. They're just over the border from Wyoming. So not even in the area of total eclipse, areas are being very heavily impacted.
So, Joe, a quick question on that. In all those 64 pages, I know there's a difference between an eclipse and solar flares and that kind of thing, but are they expecting any disruption to communications or anything like that?
Well, that was mentioned a little bit. I don't think that's likely to be a significant component of this, except for the overload of the networks from lots of people taking pictures and posting to social media and all those sort of things. So that aspect of it was certainly discussed.
So why don't you introduce Rich and let him tell us all about all those things he does.
Well, I'll be glad to. So we're really fortunate tonight to have an old friend, Rich Bradley, on with us. Rich is an IST doc from way back. He's been doing this as long as I have. Rich has a lot of experience has an extensive military background, has been doing a lot of work sort of at the national level on I'm not sure cross-disciplinary is really the right word, but just projects that involve pulling together lots of disparate response elements all into kind of a single coalition, if you will. Rich can probably talk about this much better than I can. So welcome, Rich. Say hello and tell us a little bit about what you've been up to.
Howdy, everybody. Rich Bradley from McGovern Medical School, UT Health Science Center in Houston. Well, thank you for this opportunity. I've been in the urban search and rescue system for about 22 years. I started as an emergency medicine resident with California Task Force 3 out of Menlo Park, California, and then moved to Texas for my fellowship and stayed on there. And I was with Texas Task Force 1, one of the urban search and rescue teams, when they first got going, and we just had our 20th anniversary.
Got
so a little bit about the urban search and rescue system. A lot of people are familiar, but as a recap, there are 28 urban search and rescue teams that are federal urban search and rescue teams around the country. There's also a large number of state urban search and rescue teams. The 28 federal urban search and rescue teams are all organized by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, but they are sponsored by local agencies. In most cases, they're sponsored by fire departments around the country. In some cases, like here in Texas, they're sponsored by the state. Each urban search and rescue team has different configurations. The most common configuration for deployment is as a Type 1 urban search and rescue, which is 70 people. Because they are organized by FEMA, each team deploys identically when they go out the door on a federal mission. So they have the exact same number of personnel in the exact same positions, and all the teams have pretty much the same equipment. Now, federal urban search and rescue teams are organized under Federal Emergency Support Function Number 9, which is urban search and rescue. And so their primary mission is not medical. Their primary mission is to rescue people. Initially, it was from collapsed reinforced masonry structures, but that mission has changed over time, and now the urban search and rescue team responds as an all hazards team. And in fact, most often we send it to respond for wide area missions such as floods or hurricanes. In addition to the 28 teams around the country, before I move on, the medical component, each of the teams goes completely autonomous. They're able to support themselves for 72 hours, so they carry everything they need to operate on their own for 72 hours. That would include food, water, tentage, and as you know, something that becomes important when you're deployed to a urban disaster is even toileting. So we even go out with our own accommodations for toileting for the first 3 days, because when you're deployed to an urban setting, you can't just go behind a tree. Each team has a medical component. The medical component on every team when they go out in a Type 1 configuration is 2 emergency physicians and 4 paramedics. That's part of the 70-person team. Our medical priorities are, first of all, to care for the team itself, along with our other response partners. Second, to care for disaster victims as we encounter them while they are still trapped during the rescue process. The third priority is our canines. We actually deploy, each Type 1 team goes out with 4 canines. And then the fourth priority would be the public at large. But we try not to get too engaged with general medical missions. We try to leave that for ESS-8, DMAT, and EMS personnel. Now, in addition to the 28 teams, there are 3 overhead management teams. Those are the ISTs. The ISTs go out with around 20 to 30 personnel. They can plus up as needed for large disasters. And the ISTs provide a liaison between the federal system, FEMA, and the whatever urban search and rescue teams deploy. The urban search and rescue teams, as part of their general operating procedure, never take primary responsibility for running an incident. In their federal role, they always are there to support. So the incident support team helps provide the liaison between the authority having jurisdiction and the incident commander with the other federal urban search and rescue forces in the field. So that sort of in a nutshell is how the urban search and rescue system works.
That's great, because we haven't really gone over that since I think year one when we first talked to Joe about it. So it's good to kind of reiterate how that works. I'm on a DMAT, so I'm very familiar with how those configurations for each team is very similar, as is your cache of equipment. So, Joe, we remember last year when you deployed in the fall, as Jamie and I were at Expo, to the hurricane, and you were on an IST then, right?
Yeah, that's correct, Sam. I was on the IST for Hurricane Matthew, which was a very large deployment covering 7 or 8 states. I mean, we had literally had teams, several hundred miles away from the IST that we were managing or attempting to manage anyway.
Yeah, because I remember you were running from one place to the other, and we were trying to keep track of you. So, Rich, what kind of experiences have you had? What are the ones you remember most as the USAR responders?
Well, I've been fortunate. I looked at my little log, and in the 22 years I've been doing urban search and rescue, I've deployed 23 times. A lot of those have been memorable. I'd say that one of those was Hurricane Katrina. And just speaking as a disaster responder, Hurricane Katrina was most notable for me because it showed the absolute destruction of local government. And when we got in, when our team, Texas Task Force One, was the first outside response team, or at least one of the first ones, to get into the New Orleans area after the hurricane. And when we got there, there was really nothing left. And we had staged for 2 nights before the hurricane, first in northern Louisiana, and then as the hurricane hit, we had moved forward down to Baton Rouge, And then once the hurricane passed, we moved into Metairie, which is just west of New Orleans. And we finally got the instructions to head on in. We go in buses, and we pulled into where Interstate 10, which was elevated, dipped down to ground level. And as it dipped down, it went down into the water, sort of forming the highway, the freeway would be a boat ramp. So we'd call it the boat ramp. And as we got there, we saw hundreds and hundreds of evacuees and a few boats in the water. And every boat would come in, would bring in more evacuees. And the only people, the only responders who were there staffing this reception area was a couple of guys from the Coast Guard, one guy in a pickup truck from FEMA, and a volunteer firefighter from the Northeast U.S. in his pickup truck. And that was it. There was no other responders there. And as one of the medical team managers, I was told, hey, get off the bus. We're starting a medical mission. And I started to look around and say, well, what resources do we have? What hospitals are functioning? And the answer was none. What ambulances are available? None. What helicopters are available? Well, this is right after the hurricane. Well, there really aren't any. And that really puts you in uncharted territory when you've got an unknown number of casualties that are going to be coming to you throughout the day. And as far as you know, there are no medical resources going to be available for the next 8 to 12 hours. So that was probably one of my most memorable experiences. The other thing was just the degree of disruption of all of the government services. You know, I don't mean to open up old wounds, but I mean, even dead bodies by the side of the road. Okay, we're used to seeing fatalities during disasters, but these bodies were there when we came in the morning. They were still there when we left at the end of the day. They were there when we came back again the next day. And even if you're a very experienced responder, when you realize that there's something wrong with being in a situation where nobody's there to pick up the fatalities, you really realize that you're in a situation where local government has completely dissolved.
That's a fact. In fact, we interviewed someone who was an EMS manager during that period of time. And that was quite a story because she recognized there was nothing there to work with and was trying to get help in from anywhere she could. Remember that one, Joe?
I do indeed. I remember that one very well. That was Gillette Saucy. So, you know, who was the EMS medical director for New Orleans at the time. So, you know, it's interesting that the perspectives are very similar, despite the one sort of from the inside and one from the outside. But the views are very much the same.
And it just shows I was just going to say, it just shows how flexible you guys need to be, because you never know exactly what you're getting into.
You don't. And, you know, I've been to just a really interesting number of different incidents. I mean, Hurricane Katrina sort of being the worst hurricane event. You know, I deployed for 10 days to the Space Shuttle Columbia crash. We were in Colorado for the Boulder area mudslides a few years ago. And another one of the really interesting events in a little small rural town in Washington State, at the State Route 530 slide near Oso in Washington. And it's such a rural area, one would think that how could you have a national-level disaster affecting a town with a population of just a few hundred? But what happened in Oso was there was extremely heavy rains over a short period of time. And that resulted in a major mud flow and landslide. And basically a mountain came down and buried about 30 homes, ended up taking about 33 lives. Some of the homes were buried under up to 75 feet of mud. And almost all of the people who ended up being found to be deceased were not initially found. They were missing somewhere under the mud. And so that initiated a very long, very detailed, very prolonged search and rescue mission to find those individuals. And even when we entered into the phase where we knew we were just looking for recoveries, the leadership decision from the governor of Washington was that we wouldn't stop until everyone was found. And so the governor of the state had sort of set the strategy, which is we are going to keep looking until we found every last person buried under this mountain. And that was an amazing event. It was a two-lane road, and the mud flow had blocked about half a mile of this two-lane road. And initially, for about the first 5 or 6 days, the only way to go from one side of the mud flow to the other was to drive 2 hours clear around the mountain to get to the other side. Eventually, they were able to get a power line road graded and expanded so that we could take a power line road along one of the side hills to get from one side to the other. But that was a really extensive search and rescue operation, required a lot of resources, and also showed the value of using good intelligence. Our planning folks did a terrific job of working with the local authorities. And by taking a few of the people who were recovered, bodies that were recovered, they were able to do predictive mapping and determine where they predicted all of the remaining human remains would be. And using their predictive modeling, they were able to pretty much point out right on the areas that needed to be searched. And that was the key in this very large area to completing the mission, getting a 100% recovery of all of the human remains. Interestingly, that mission was also the largest ever U.S. deployment of human remains dogs. And there was over 100 human remains dogs deployed from all around the country to assist in that mission. And it was really challenging because it was not freezing, but it was cool, and cool being in the 40s and 50s. And then the dogs were searching in mud and water. So we had cooler weather with mud and water conditions. And that led to some real concerns for hypothermia for our canines. And our medical staff, along with our veterinarians, were very busy making sure that our dogs stayed healthy.
Oh, that's a big job in and of itself. So you were talking about Katrina and, you know, the lack of local resources, but can we talk a little bit about how you interact with local resources? Maybe
you
bet. Also was a good example of it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as I mentioned, the federal government resources, whether it's DMAT or Urban Search and Rescue or any other team, always makes a point of saying, you know, we are not here to take over. Urban Search and Rescue is a field that is dominated by firefighters. Other than the physicians and some of the EMS personnel, some engineers and some canine handlers, the vast majority of people in the Urban Search and Rescue system are firefighters. But they're very careful. We're all very careful to say when we come in, we are not taking over. We're here to support you, and we're here to support the incident commander. And that's really important because a lot of times we come into communities when they are having their worst day of the century. And a lot of times they've been up and working for 72 or 96 hours by the time we get there. Their nerves are on edge. And they're really sensitive when someone comes in and they're afraid somebody's going to say, you all aren't handling this right. We're from the feds. We're going to take over. And so the best urban search and rescue leaders will say, you know, we'll do a good job of saying, we're not taking over. We're here to support you. let me tell you what tools we can bring to the table. Now, on a couple of our incidents recently in the past few years, the incident support team has deployed with a local incident management team. The incident management teams we've been with have been from the National Forest Service, but they are also multi-jurisdictional teams. So not everybody on the incident management teams are federal employees. A lot of them come from local fire departments. Some are paid, some are volunteers. And they are pre-rostered teams that can respond to any type of incident. They're all-risk incident management teams. But when we deployed with them, being that they were led by the Forest Service, when we met up with them, they were quick to admit, hey, look, we're an all-hazard incident management team, but really what we do is forest fires. And we don't know how to do search and rescue. So our incident support teams from the Urban Search and Rescue System did, I think, a really admirable job of integrating with them and saying, okay, we are not going to take over your job as the incident management team, but we are going to partner up with you and we're going to help you understand the search and rescue component of ICS that you guys do all the time. And one of the areas that I think that's really interesting as we do this marrying up with the incident management teams is in the medical area, because standard ICS, which is usually in big wildfires, doesn't usually do much in the way of medical. I mean, if you think of the ICS structure, what does the ICS structure have? It has a medical unit that reports to, I think, the services branch, if I remember correctly, of the logistics section. So, you know, the medical unit is four levels of administration down below the incident commander. That's not how Urban Search and Rescue structures their medical component. In Urban Search and Rescue, the medical component, we use different terminology than ICS. We call it the medical officer. But the medical officer is part of the command and general staff. And the medical officer on the incident support team reports directly to the incident support team leader. But what we brought when we married up with the incident management team is we brought a wealth of medical experience that in the incident management team, it was just a paramedic who knew how to be a fireline paramedic and knew how to organize a medical unit and make sure that ambulances were deployed on the line. But there was so much more to what you need for medical support of a catastrophic incident than that. So it really shows the importance of having well-trained and experienced disaster medicine physicians and disaster experienced EMS personnel, paramedics in the incident management system.
Rich, this is Joe. That's beautifully said. And I'm sitting here thinking about how many times I've seen and been a part of that on our myriad of deployments over the last 25 years. And it's always interesting. I get a real sense that for a lot of federal-based disaster entities, not to pick on anybody, but it's just the nature of the system, they don't know what they don't know about medicine and the impact that someone like you just described, someone like yourself, can add to that situation from, environmental-related issues to infectious disease-related issues to the simple care and systems issues that are part of what we do on every deployment that we go on.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And you know, I'll give you a good example. The OSO incident, we integrated so well with the incident management team. I think that was the Northern Washington Type 2 incident management team that I was actually dual-hatted as both the Urban Search and Rescue IST medical officer, and I was also the medical, I can't remember my title, I'm going to say medical branch director, but I was part of the ICS also, reporting to the operations section chief. And because they had no one else to fill that role, the paramedic who normally deployed with that team was working on his task work, and he chose to deploy as a situation unit leader trainee. And they asked if I would step up, and so I stepped up, and I worked both sides of the fence. And just to give an example of some of the needs, some of the things, some of the tasks that fell to me at the OSO incident was coordinating all of the EMS personnel that deployed to the incident. We deployed two ALS and a BLS unit and two fireline paramedics every day. So working with the local authorities on that. Now, that's your typical medical unit leader stuff on a big incident. But I also coordinated with the military to bring in two advanced practice providers to provide advanced on-scene care because the scene was so far from the closest medical clinic. Should anybody become injured or ill on scene, they provided a forward medical element beyond the EMS level. I also was responsible for bringing in veterinary care for the what ended up being 100 canines on site. I was also responsible for bringing in the critical incident stress teams. I was also responsible for working with the local authorities for managing the public health implications of the mud and the environmental concerns that we were working in. No one knew how much of the sewer system was disrupted and in the mud, how much sewage we had in the mud, how much household hazardous goods were in the mud. So all of the environmental and public health issues. So there was a number of medical things that are outside of the standard drill for a incident management team to worry about that came into play on this incident. And I would argue those things are going to come in any all hazards catastrophe beyond a standard wildfire. Wildfire IMTs, they're all hazards IMTs, but they do wildfires primarily. They're great at what they do. These are some of the most smartest, hardest working, wonderful guys and gals I've met. But their experience is fires, and their experience is not catastrophes that go beyond the fire realm where they have things like diverse medical concerns to think about. And that's why we need to continue to build our disaster medical and our disaster EMS expertise.
And folks, we're going to wrap up this episode of the Disaster Podcast. We'll split this episode into two. We just kept talking to Dr. Richard Bradley, and there was a lot of good stuff about USAR response and IST and groups and everything else. And we wanted to continue that discussion. So we're going to pick up with part two of this episode in next week's show. So check that out. In the meantime, I want to thank our sponsor, Dr. Joe Holly, and the rest of the team over at Paragon Medical Education Group. They do a fantastic job of bringing experiential training, just training like you haven't even seen before for disaster response to your jurisdiction. And I can't say that enough. They just do things in a different way. It's not death by PowerPoint. It's not the same old thing. They've got experienced responders for everything from active shooter response to major disaster, natural disaster responses. And you just I can't say enough about them. Check them out over at Medical Education Group, Paragon Medical Education Group, and that's paragonmedicalgroup.com. You can also find them on Twitter at ParagonMedEDU, and they also are active on our Facebook group, and there are links also in each episode page over at disasterpodcast.com. But follow up with them, and while you're there, make sure you say thank you for helping to support the Disaster Podcast each week. If you enjoy this show, you at least should drop them a line and thank them for continuing to support us and help us bring this episode out to you each week. And in case, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. I'm going to go ahead and wrap up as we always do here on the show, and go ahead and remind you that disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.